Do 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 do.
And we're back.
We're back for another episode of
From X to Z,
a multi-generational podcast.
You were right.
A podcast where we have multi-generational conversations about
things that matter
and some that don't. And today we are talking about the Netflix series Adolescence. And boy, do we have stuff we have to talk about.
We have articles. Mm-hmm. We have written thoughts. We have
we have so many things. We, full disclosure, tried to do an episode about this podcast. We recorded an entire episode about this.
It was like over an hour long.
But it was right after I had watched it, and shortly after you had watched it, and so we were still processing this, and it was all over the place, so we decided we needed to do it over. We needed to kind of organize our thoughts a little bit better, but I want to start off by saying, if you have not watched this, you need to watch this. It is a very good show. It is also a very intriguing, thought-provoking, relevant show to our society.
To our time. It's a show that you will need to talk about after.
Yes.
It, like, provokes conversation.
Yes. And I saw a picture of a billboard in Los Angeles about this show that said, "Adolescence, we are all still processing." Mm. And let me tell ya, sister, that is the truth.
Yes.
I mean,
absolutely. Because this has been probably like 3 weeks since I've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still things that I haven't quite processed yet.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yes. So we're going to talk about it today.
Yes.
I want to start off by saying there will be spoilers.
Yes.
If you have not watched this and you would like to watch it without spoilers, we're going to need you to come back later and listen to us. But if you have watched it and are interested in what we think about it, keep listening. If you have not watched it but don't care about the spoilers, you want to get our take on it before you watch it, keep on listening. So I wanted to first get that out there, that there will be spoilers as we talk. We're going to talk about all of it. And also, some trigger warnings, because this is a show that pertains sexual assault, talks about murder, talks about teens participating in these types of activities. So I just want to give some trigger warnings on that. So if that's difficult for you to hear, then you also might not want to listen any further.
Yes.
Okay.
Violence against women.
Violence against women.
Mm-hmm. Misogyny. All of those things.
Yes. We're getting into it.
Yes,
so. Okay, let's start by talking about the show first. Okay. So, Adolescence, it is streaming now on Netflix. It premiered in March, end of March. To date, it has over 96 million views worldwide.
That's amazing.
This is not just...
This was not like a United States.
No, it's not even set...
Or a miniseries either.
It's set in the United Kingdom.
Yeah.
And Netflix says that the series, which was created by Stephen Graham and Jack Thorne, is a dramatization of how easy it is for a boy to get radicalized online. Stephen Graham, who is the creator and also one of the actors, he plays Jamie's dad, Jamie is the main character. The show was inspired by recent news events of distressing violent crimes. For example, in 2021, a 12-year-old named Ava White was fatally stabbed by a 14-year-old boy in Graham's home city of Liverpool. And in 2023, a 15-year-old female, Elian, was attacked with a kitchen knife by a 17-year-old outside a Croydon shopping center. Graham says that the story shocked him and made him ask, what is going on? Mm-hmm. What's happening in society where a boy stabs a girl to death? And why is this happening today? Adolescence shows how a seemingly normal 13-year-old boy has some inward self-esteem issues, some self-loathing issues, how that situation can cause young teens to be susceptible to radicalization without anyone even noticing.
Yeah.
So that is the premise of Adolescence. That is the creation of, I guess.
Mm-hmm. The show, the miniseries.
The inspiration behind it. Mm-hmm. There's only 4 episodes, so it's a short one.
Mm-hmm. About an hour long.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about each episode and give you our thoughts on that, and then we'll wrap it up with a whole bunch of other goodies.
We have goodies at the end.
Man, we've been talking about this for weeks.
Really.
I know this is going to date me, but this is like one of those, as they would say, conversations around the water cooler. Oh. Like, this is one of those shows that everybody's talking
Gen
about.
Gen X statement right there.
It is. I mean, I'm teetering in boomer territory with that one.
I don't know what that is. So,
do you know what a water cooler is?
Well, yeah, I know what a water cooler is, but like, tell me.
So,
what is that from?
Like, office culture.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Is that people would stand around the water cooler and chat, gossip, or whatever. And so, standing around the water cooler, chatting around the water cooler, whatever the phrase is, that's what that means. It's basically like what the talk is.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Like I said, that might be dabbling in boomer territory with that one. Another really interesting thing about this show is that each episode was done in one take. And I'm talking about the acting, and I'm also talking about the camera angle. So mm-hmm. if you're watching, you'll notice that the camera, it's one camera. And whenever a scene changes, it follows the person out, like a person out of the room into mm-hmm. the next scene. And then if it needs to go somewhere else, it'll follow somebody else down that scene. And the entire episode was recorded in one take. And they said that if they got to the end of it and someone messed up and they couldn't like roll with it, then they had to reshoot the whole thing over again.
Yes.
And when you watch it, that's amazing because like there are some episodes, there's a lot of extras. And everybody had to be in mm-hmm. their spot, in their space. Mm-hmm. Like the timing had to be perfect. And so that's a very interesting thing outside of the storytelling of mm-hmm. it. But that's part of the storytelling.
It is. I think and Jamie, the actor that played Jamie, the main character, mm-hmm. he said that they would do 2 takes a day. Mm-hmm. And he, if you're interested in this, but in episode 3, he saves the episode. And that's actually the episode they use because the actress who played the psychiatrist, she was supposed to say Instagram, but she said Facebook. And he played it off as Facebook, you old person kind of situation. So it was like, oh, wow. And he's never acted before. This that's is amazing. His first thing. So I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
Like, wow, that's good. Good for you.
It, like I said, it leads to the storytelling of it because you're not fast forwarding to a different scene. It's like you're in it. And once we start talking about it, you'll understand what we're talking about. But it's like you're in it. So you're feeling the tension. You're feeling the emotions. You're feeling impatient.
Yes.
Like in the first episode, the nurse that's coming is late and you're mm-hmm. feeling that impatience mm-hmm. of like, okay, come on, where is she?
Yep. Literally a fly on the wall.
You really are. You are with them in the car. You are with them as they're walking down the hallway. Like you're processing this as they would be processing this. And so it's a really interesting take, and I think it takes you on the journey with them. So it's a really cool way of telling the story.
I think it was the second episode, it was after the school episode, there was a switch from the camera on the ground mm-hmm. to a drone mm-hmm. and they had to attach it mm-hmm. so that it could be one take.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, that is crazy. Because at the time when I was watching it, I didn't realize it was one take.
Yeah.
And then I was like, wait, how did they do that? Mm-hmm. And it's just really fascinating.
Yeah, super cool. So if you haven't watched it yet, pay attention to that. If mm-hmm. you have watched it, maybe you already realized that. And if you've watched it and you didn't, go back and watch it again.
Yes.
It's really cool. Okay. So episode 1. 13-year-old Jamie Miller's house is raided by police. He's arrested on suspicion of murdering a female classmate. Her name is Katie. He's a 13-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. The police raid his house.
In the morning. It was like 6
o'clock in the morning. His mom looks like she was probably making breakfast. Mm-hmm. I think her hair was wet, probably just taking a shower. His sister's in the bathroom getting ready for school. He's still in the bed. Dad just got home from work a little while ago. And so obviously a very unsuspecting family for the police to raid. Later, the attorney says that that's kind of standard for such a violent crime. Mm-hmm. So we learn that this is a violent crime. And Jamie gets out of the bed and he has wet himself. And the detective lets his dad come in the room and help him change his clothes and things like that. So as you can expect, Jamie, again, 13-year-old boy, is crying.
Yeah.
He's terrified. He continues to maintain his innocence, saying that he didn't do anything wrong. Mom and dad are obviously
extremely
shocked.
Confused. What is going on?
They are convinced that this is a mistake. You have the wrong house. You have the wrong person. We'll get this all cleared up. And so they take Jamie to the police station. The parents follow behind. And it's, again, like you feel the tension of this moment because you're going with them. Like the parents have questions. And I think us as viewers, we have questions. Like,
yeah,
what's going
on?
Why are they taking them? What kind of evidence do they have to believe that he did this? And again, just the waiting, you actually feel that impatience and that tension and the processing of his arrest. The attorney that meets with the family. Again, this is set in the UK, so it's a little bit different than what we would expect or be familiar with here. But Jamie is a minor, so he is allowed to name what they call an appropriate adult.
Yeah.
It can be a parent or it can be someone else that the court appoints for him. He chooses his dad.
Yep.
And that was surprising to his mom. The mom was like, why did he pick you? And it was interesting to see the dynamic. When you watch this, when I watched this the first time, I've watched it a couple times now. When I watched this the first time, I thought he probably chose his dad because he's scared.
Right.
Thinks his dad will protect him, stand up for him. But let's talk about episode one.
Okay.
Oh, and at the end of the episode, again, spoiler alert.
This is not a whodunit.
Right.
This is more of a why.
Exactly. So we learn at the end of the first episode that there is video, surveillance video of Jamie stabbing Katie 7 times.
Yep.
They have it on video. That's how the episode ends.
Yes.
So it does not take long to know that he did do it, yep. Although he still maintains he didn't do anything wrong. Mm-hmm. And so that's how the episode ends. So again, we learn right away, right away that he did it. Okay, so let's talk about it.
Let's talk about that part. Okay, so we're jumping towards like the middle of this episode, but since we're talking about that, I find it interesting his choice of words, because whenever his family was like, what's going on, he kept repeating, I didn't do anything wrong, instead of I didn't do it or I didn't do that, because he did do that. But he saw it as he didn't do anything wrong, like it was justified. And so I didn't catch that the first time that I listened to it. And then whenever I realized that later, like after reading some commentary on it, I was like, oh, that adds a whole nother layer.
Yeah, it does.
It justified to stab your classmate. Like, wow. And fully lying straight, because his dad asked him, look at me straight in the eyes and tell me, did you do this? And he says, no, I didn't. He looks him in the eye and says, no, I did not.
And his dad says, promise.
Yeah.
And he said, promise.
Yeah.
The first time I watched it, I was like, he didn't do it.
Yeah,
I know. He didn't do it.
I know.
And then we see the video, and I still was like, but he is adamant that he didn't do it. So I still thought, maybe he didn't do it, because for me, I don't feel like it's a stretch for a lot of people. I think people will be split on this, but for me, it was really hard to see someone who is so good at lying. And so when I saw that, I was like, he didn't do it. There's no way that he did it.
And so young, though.
Yes, because he looked his dad in the eye and said, no, I did not do it. I promise. I thought he didn't do it, which is interesting, because I don't trust people easily. I am a terrible liar.
Right.
Like, terrible.
Oh, yeah.
I have no poker face. It is written all over my face. Like, I don't do it because I cannot do it. I am terrible at it. So when I see people that are really, really good at it, it is scary for me, because that is terrifying that people can be so good at blatantly lying at people, looking you in the eye and just lying. And he did it really well. He did it really well to the point where maybe I'm just really naive, but I even thought he didn't do it. Somebody else. Yeah. There's some explanation for this where he did not do this. So
that episode was really like, it just took you through, it walked you through all of his steps he had to complete when he got to the juvenile detention center or the jail or
the exam. Yeah. They had to fingerprint him and
had to search him to see if he had any marks of, you know, a fight.
And the emotion. His dad's in the room while that's going. So he needs his appropriate adult because obviously they're examining him and checking him. There's a nurse in the room because I think they also needed to take blood samples. And then there are police officers in the room and the attorney.
Yeah.
And it's like a medical exam room. Mm-hmm. And I think like the emotion, there's a lot of silence in that because, again, you're in real time. They're going through the process. And I felt the weight of that. Yeah. Like,
it was very heavy because I don't think the nurse knew. You know, the nurse didn't know the details. Uh-huh. She's just there to do her job.
Right.
And she felt for him. Yes. I think that she made a comment. She was like, I hate
juvenile
cases like this because it's heart-wrenching.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you feel the first episode.
Yes.
And then that changes a little bit, too.
A little bit.
It's still heart-wrenching. Don't get me wrong. But I think I agree with you. I did feel for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hoping also that I was like, oh, maybe he didn't do it. Maybe he didn't do it. I was hoping so bad for that. But he did.
I mean, it's pretty damning evidence. Mm-hmm. They have surveillance video of him with his friends out. And then they were able to construct a timeline where they see that he's following her, Katie. And then they have the whole confrontation on video. So it's pretty good evidence, but they still don't know why he did it.
Right. The why is still
and they didn't have weapon. Like a weapon.
Yeah.
And so that leads us to episode two.
Yep. The two detectives that were at the house when they arrested Jamie, they visit Jamie's school and classmates trying to find information about a motive and locate the murder weapon, which was a kitchen knife. We meet Jamie's best friends, Ryan and Tommy, that were with him the night of the murder. We also meet Katie's best friend. This episode introduces us to the idea of the manosphere and incel culture. I also saw something interesting about this episode, that this episode was trying to portray the school system, the understaffed school system, with discipline issues, with respect issues, with chaos ensuing in the classroom. And so I thought that was an interesting part. I obviously noticed that, but I didn't realize that that was like intentional, you know?
Right. When I was watching that, honestly, I thought it looked like every other middle school.
Normal.
I know this is the UK, but it looked like a middle school in the United States. And maybe that's part of the point too, and maybe that's part of the message, and maybe that's part of the conversation. But it was very representative, in my opinion, of school, period. Yeah. Like middle schools across America, across apparently
the world
countries. I didn't pick up on that the first time either, but that's my take on it. I'm like, I see that, but I also feel that that's representative of middle schools everywhere, which is telling, I guess, of the world we're in. So we talked about the school. There's a lot in this episode, a lot more than what we've talked about. A lot of details in this episode. So
this is the same school that one of the detective's sons is attending.
Yes.
So this is something we did not talk about for the first episode. So his son, the detective's son, called him because he didn't want to go to school.
Yes.
His stomach ache.
Mm-hmm.
Or he says he has a stomach ache.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that was important at all to it.
Well, we see the detective's son bullied at school. There are people that as they walk by the cafeteria, they put their trash on his plate, and somebody asked him for money or made him give him money or something.
Yeah, that's right.
There was some bullying happening mm-hmm. with his son. What you were talking about, there was a lot of disrespect, which that was surprising for me because I don't know if this is representative of teenagers today, but even now as an adult, the respect that I have for law enforcement, if there was a police officer in our school asking questions because someone had been murdered, we would have been terrified.
Yeah.
Not guilty, guilty. We right, would have just been like, terrified yeah. about the fact that there are police here
right.
asking questions. And we would have been so scared mm-hmm. straight. We would have been on our best behavior. Mm-hmm. And they were not.
No.
It was almost like a joke to them.
Right. Yeah. And that like starts out with these two boys talking about, oh, did you hear their... Like, they had already known, like, what happened. Katie's best friend.
Yes. I don't remember her name, but yes,
Katie's best friend. Don't remember her name either. She was obviously grieving. Her teacher was like, I told you that it would probably be best to stay home today.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually confronts a boy
mm-hmm.
and says, you killed her.
Mm-hmm. And it was it was Ryan. Which yes. is one of Jamie's best friends mm-hmm. who was with him that
mm-hmm.
night.
Mm-hmm. And so then I was like, oh, so he didn't kill her. That was Giant. No.
I thought that too. I thought, oh, he did it. He
right,
did it.
Right.
And I thought, did they switch clothes? So episode two is also where we learn from the detective's son the term incel culture.
Mm-hmm.
So in episode one, yes. we see that Katie, the victim, has commented on Jamie, the murder suspect, on some of his Instagram posts.
Yes.
And the detectives think they're friends mm-hmm. because she's posted comments to his Instagram. And Jamie says that they weren't exactly friends.
Right.
And they didn't really know each other outside of class.
Mm-hmm.
And that's episode one. Episode two, the detective's son sheds a little bit more light on what may have been part of the relationship. Mm-hmm. And
he said, Dad, you're missing the point.
In the comments that she made and what they mean in teen speak. So that's when we learn the term incel. So Katie commented on one of Jamie's posts referring to him as an incel. And that's when they talk a little bit about the manosphere
mm-hmm.
and Andrew Tate. And his influence.
And blue pill, red pill.
So let's talk about that a little bit.
Okay.
What is the manosphere? The manosphere is basically websites, online presence, blogs, social media, Reddit forums, mm-hmm. all kinds of things that promote masculinity, misogyny, and opposition to feminism. It's not great.
Yeah.
It's not a positive message of manhood.
Of masculinity. It's
yeah.
not good masculinity.
It's not good masculinity.
It's
not,
toxic.
It's not masculinity of as an example of manhood.
Yeah.
It is masculinity as an example of manhood at the expense of women.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So it's toxic masculinity,
mm-hmm.
but the manosphere is basically referring to all of the spaces
yes.
where toxic masculinity is promoted and revered and perpetuated. Incel refers to an involuntary celibate. Became really popular with Andrew Tate, who is a misogynistic influencer.
Yes. He is currently facing charges in Romania
mm-hmm.
for trafficking.
For human trafficking.
Yes.
And rape, allegedly.
Allegedly.
Mm-hmm. So he is credited with not creating the term incel culture, because that's been around for a while, but in really popularizing it even more than it had been prior to him. So Andrew Tate is, well, what Laura just said, he is currently being charged in Romania with some really bad things. He has a platform. He is a fighter, former fighter. He grew notoriety and a huge following on TikTok and Instagram. If I'm not mistaken, he has been banned from those platforms mm-hmm. because of his messaging that promotes violence and other things against women. I want to talk about this for a second because I had heard of Andrew Tate, but I did not know much about him other than he's a huge misogynist and he has some very dangerous messaging. But this prompted a really good conversation. I think that's one of the things, that's the main thing that this show really, really does super well, is that it gets you talking.
Yes.
And what it did for me is it got me talking because I have a 13-year-old son. So this hit home for me to be like, what, this is like things that he's being exposed to. These are the conversations that are happening in his realm of influence, in his school, with his friends. And so I asked him after I watched this episode if he knew who Andrew Tate is. And he did. He said, the fighter. And I was like, yeah, what do you know about him? And he said, that's really all I know. And I said, have you ever watched anything that he's put out, like on YouTube? Because our son does not have social media.
Right.
But he watches YouTube. And, and so things can still get to him, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I asked if he had watched anything that he had put out there or heard of anything. And he said that he had not. And so we had a really good conversation about it because I told him some of the things that Andrew Tate puts out, why that is bad and why that is dangerous. And even though my son doesn't watch that, he has friends who might, and those friends might be influenced by things that they see in that aspect. And so it just was a really good conversation about how you can get these micro messages of misogyny and anti-feminism and oppression of women or other people groups. And it doesn't seem like it's bad because it's not blatantly like you should be doing this. And so it's these small little micro messages that you get and that you hear and that you see that for, especially at the age that they are, their brains are still forming, that starts to form your view on women and how women should be treated. Yes. And how, and what it looks like to be a man. And so that's what happened in Jamie's case in this show that we're talking about. It was these, it's not subliminal messaging. It's micro messaging. I think.
Yeah.
Because it's not this like, I mean, and okay, listen, if you watch anything that Andrew Tate puts out there, it's not a micro message. Like he's saying,
oh, no, Andrew Tate is not a micro message.
Right. But, but my thing is like when it's filtered through his friends, my son's friends and stuff, even though he's not seeing this, because I think if he were to watch that, he'd be like, oh, no, this is this is bad.
Right.
This is bad. I can't listen. I was talking to a young adult recently about this. He was in college when Andrew Tate became really popular. So there was this whole culture on college campuses where, or men, I guess, young adults in college were picking fights or arguments with women. The way that they explained it to me was that on their campus, they saw men kind of poking women for fun. And they would say things that Andrew Tate had said or whatever, just to get a rise out of the women. And they thought it was funny. And so when I was talking to them about it, the guy said that he totally does not agree with anything that Andrew Tate puts out now. But when he was in college, he remembers seeing some of his stuff and being like, yeah, he has a point. Yeah, I can see that. And he's like, that's how it works. That's how he gets you, because he says something that's half true or partly right. And so it legitimizes him. You think, okay, he's got a good point there. And then he turns it into a different direction and you're already following his train of thought. And that's really dangerous. So, and I think we're going to talk a little bit later after we go through all the episodes, but, some of the comments that the creators had said when they were doing research. And I think that's what we're going to see with them too, is that you see these things and some of it is just outright like, no, absolutely not. Like, we are not promoting that. We are not agreeing with that. But I think a lot of men in not just this manosphere of the blatant stuff. There's also like a lot of areas where this misogynistic messaging is getting to teens and adult men.
Absolutely.
And I don't think they're realizing it because it doesn't seem like it's this flashing light message of oppressing women. It's this very small.
It's manipulating them in their most vulnerable time.
Yes. It's baiting them into it and then feeding them more and more.
Going back to whenever that boy was talking to his dad, who is the detective, and he brought up the incel culture stuff. He said, yes, that's what she was doing. His dad asks him more about incel culture, saying, is he saying that he is a virgin? And he replied and he said, well, she's saying he always will be. When they say you're an incel, you're going to be a virgin forever, is what she was meaning.
Yes.
So it's intentional to hurt his feelings on purpose as a way to kind of defend herself because she was feeling threatened.
Yes. And so to clarify, incel is involuntarily celibate.
Yeah.
But that's an insult because, like you said, it means that there always will
it
be.
It will always be that way.
The topic of incel culture, I think I read somewhere that it got 2.6 million views or searches or Reddit boards or something like that. Like Reddit has actually taken it down now, or they filter it out or block it. I don't know. But people are actually like, for some it's an insult. For some it is their culture. Like they will say, I am an incel. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, they are mad about it. They're not happy about being an incel. They are mad about it and they blame women for it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the important clarification to make, is that incel means involuntarily celibate, but they're blaming women for it because it's a heterosexual thing too. Mm-hmm. They desire to have a relationship with a woman, but they have been rejected or turned down by women. And so that is why they are, quote, involuntarily celibate.
Right.
And they're angry.
Yep.
And they're blaming women.
Mm-hmm.
Because
they've been rejected.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So, okay. Moving on to episode 3.
This was my personal favorite episode. This was very good.
This was a hard one.
Yeah.
So episode 3 takes place 7 months after the murder. A forensic psychologist meets with Jamie at a youth detention facility. She's preparing a pretrial report basically on his mental capacity. So the psychologist assures Jamie that she's not there to assess whether he's innocent, whether he's guilty, whether he did it or not. She is there to evaluate his understanding of the circumstances around the case. So not the case itself. She asks Jamie questions about his attitudes towards masculinity, about women, about himself. Jamie reveals to her that Katie had sent a topless photo to a classmate, and that classmate then shared it
around the school.
Everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Without her consent.
Without her consent. And so this hurt Katie. And this is a very interesting part of this conversation. Jamie asked Katie out, and the reason he asked her out at that time, he says, is because he figured she would be weak. Basically, he thought she would be emotionally vulnerable after her pictures were sent to everyone. Because she would be emotionally vulnerable and weak, then she would be willing to go out with Jamie. So she said no, and then proceeded to leave the comments that we were talking about from the previous episode, started to leave comments on his Instagram. And so throughout the interview, Jamie's mood kind of fluctuates in between like being friendly to the psychologist to being aggressive towards her. If she says things that he doesn't like, his reactions are really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Very snarky.
Very snarky. We see him display his views on women through his actions of how he treats the psychiatrist.
Yes.
One minute he's friendly, but then he gets really angry when she appears to be exerting any kind of authority over him or
any man.
Yeah. A male guard walks in and she kind of waves her hand to tell him, like, I've got this. Don't come in.
I'm in control of the situation.
Uh-huh. And Jamie did not like that. Mm-hmm. And he gets pretty aggressive with her.
Verbally aggressive.
Yeah. And says some kind of comment about, like, oh, you just wave your hand and you think that
you think that you are all that, or you think that you're in control. you think that you're the woman.
So he has several outbursts of anger. He admits that he was tempted to grope or touch Katie during the confrontation that they had. And he accidentally confesses to the murder. Again, we know he did it because there's video proof that there's no question. But he accidentally admits it in his anger in this psychiatric evaluation. After he accidentally admits to the murder, the psychiatrist informs him that this will be their last session, and he kind of loses it.
Yeah.
He keeps asking her if she likes him.
That was a constant question. He was trying to understand her motive. And he kept mocking her because her response back to him was, I'm just trying to understand your understanding. And he was like, that's when he confessed too. He said, well, you're just trying to understand my understanding of your understanding of my understanding of what I did. And then as soon as he says that, he flips his chair and is like, I did not just say that.
Yeah.
And he loses it because he felt tricked.
Yes. And then I caught today when I rewatched that ending that as the guard is taking him out, he's screaming and he says, don't you tell them what I did. That was interesting. So, yeah, at the very end of the scene, he's getting pulled out by the guard, but he's asking her, he wants to know, do you like me?
Yeah.
And he says, not like in a romantic way, just like as a person, do you like me? But she does not give him an answer to that question. And he gets very agitated because she won't answer and starts screaming. Mm-hmm. And he's just desperate for her to say that she likes him as a person.
Mm-hmm. And back to Katie. So that is something that he asked her, the psychiatrist, and he said, I could have touched her, but I didn't. That makes me better. Right? Don't you think? Don't you think? He was looking for that affirmation and that, like, what is that other word? Like the, you are a good person. So consistently.
And I think that speaks to the gradual brainwashing that he experienced, because as we said, he kept saying, I didn't do anything wrong. So I truly believe in his mind, he had justified what he did, because in this episode, we learn a lot more about his friendship, if you could call it that, relationship with Katie, and that she bullied him and that he was angry with her because of how she treated him and rejected him. So he believed that he was justified in his actions, and he really believed that because he showed some form of restraint by not sexually assaulting her, that he did something good.
Yeah, that he should be congratulated for that and affirmed that's the right thing to do, but that he didn't, but he could have, but that makes him better than the other people who aren't. Women aren't allowed to say no. They're just not.
Which is crazy that he actually believed, actually believed that he did a good thing by refraining from that. I mean, that's crazy. Think about that. Yeah.
I know. The ethical and moral compass of this boy.
Here's the scary thing, Laura. It's not just this boy.
I know.
This is a reflection of so many other boys and men in the manosphere. And that is the scary thing.
Well, and when we talked about Andrew Tate, we're not just talking about him because of him. He is named by name in this series. Like, they talk about him by name.
Yes, they mention him.
Yeah, so
like, with the incel culture.
Yeah, yeah, being a part of this. And right. So that we're not like just bringing him up all of a sudden. Like, he's a part of this. He's ingrained in this culture.
Yes.
I thought too, something that was really interesting was the guard at the cameras. So the psychiatrist, she comes out to take a break in between a little outburst that Jamie had. And so she comes out and she wants to watch something on the
surveillance cameras.
Surveillance cameras.
She wants to see what he's doing in the room now that she's stepped out of the room, I think.
Yeah, was it that or was she like rewatching something? I can't remember. She was watching him. And so the guard or the guy who was working in that office continued to talk to her and she's working. And I just thought it was really interesting, that part of the episode. Like, this is not a part of Jamie's story at all.
Right.
So this had to have been on purpose. Mm-hmm. And she is mid-work. She's mid-thought. She previously had told him that she cannot know what the previous psychiatrists had decided and what their end
questions. Yeah, their questions. She can't know anything about any. She's one of two or three psychiatrists that have evaluated him.
Yeah.
And so she's very professional and very clear that she can't know anything
exactly
that the others have talked to him about.
Yeah. And this man, he was, well, are you sure that you don't want to know? Because I can tell you. Mm-hmm. And do you need help with this and all of this kind of stuff? And I can only imagine if there was a man that had walked in, this would have been a male psychiatrist and walked in and told this guard, I can't know anything. This guard would have probably said, yes, sir, and sat there and let him do his job because he's a man and he is competent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But she was a younger female who needed help. And according to him, mm-hmm. he did not view her, at least the way that I saw it, he did not view her as a competent professional person.
Mm-hmm.
She was a young woman who needed his help.
That's it's interesting.
Just so fascinating.
I kind of got that he was flirting with her.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. He definitely was. And that's the other thing too, is the respect. If the psychiatrist would have been a male, the guard would have stepped back and let the male psychiatrist do his job. Mm-hmm. But she had to fight through him talking to her while also focusing on the cameras, while also processing her own thoughts and emotions. Like, yes. Multitasking. Yes. This is why we're good at it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think another interesting thing in that session, she asked Jamie a lot of questions about what he thinks being a man looks like or should be. She asks him questions about the men in his life, his dad, his grandfather. So she's trying to get this picture of his idea of a man.
Interesting parallel here to when he told the psychiatrist that he was better than the other boys because he did not touch Katie. She asks him about his dad's relationship with his mom. And he said, well, they fight sometimes like normal couples, but he never hits her. So that's good. And it's wonder where he got that idea from. I'm not saying fully, but he never hits her. So that's good. Well, yeah, you shouldn't hit someone.
Right.
I'm sorry. That's not a better thing. That's just basic human decency.
But his view was that he's just a normal guy.
His dad is like on this pedestal because he does not hit his mom. And I just thought that was an interesting parallel.
That is an interesting observation.
Sorry, I got a little heated there.
No, that's okay. I think it brings up a good point for me too. I have talked to women who, like, that's their definition of what a good man is like. Sometimes it blows my mind. And I think, speaking of generational things that we talk about on this podcast, I think part of it's generational too. But when I talk to women that are boomers or older Gen X, there's this tendency to make excuses for their spouses. And I don't mean their spouses are bad, but I mean, if they say something bad about their spouse, like they're just venting or complaining about something, there's this need I've noticed to counter that with, but at least he's never hit me, or but at least he does the laundry, but at least he helps with the kids. Every time that someone feels the need to do that, I want to be like, you don't have to do that. Yeah. Like, you can just feel a way, you can just be irritated or whatever without having to counter that with, but at least he's not this, that, or at least he does do this or that. Because I also have the thought, I want to hear your thoughts because you're making a lot of faces.
I'm making a face because I have this TV show clip in my head that it's just like going on repeat. It's about this that you're talking about, and it's hysterical.
Well, but
in
also,
a sad way.
It also makes me wonder, or I know the answer to this already. Have you ever heard a husband venting about his wife and then being, but at least she's really good with the kids? But at least she cooks dinner. But at least she does the laundry. Like, no man would ever feel the need to, like, give his wife a pat on the back for doing those things.
Or if you're going to pat her on the back, then men that do that actually probably respect their wives.
But it's just an interesting thing that I have noticed. And in the conversation of this show, Amy feels like, but he's never hit her. And I feel like there are a lot of women who feel that way too, but at least he's never done this.
The TV, the clip that I have in my head that I'm laughing about, it's not funny, it's sad, but it's Anna Duggar.
Uh-huh.
And there is a clip from their show, 19 Kids and Counting at the time, and she's talking about Josh, mm-hmm. and that's a whole rabbit trail we could go down at right. some point.
Google it.
Google Josh Duggar if you want, maybe don't, but this is before all of the scandals mm-hmm. came out. I think they were living in D.C. at the time, and she was talking about how he would not take out the trash, and she was like, you know, either they're interviewing right now for their reality TV show. She was like, every time that I look at the trash and it's overflowing, I just think, well, at least I have a husband.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And maybe now it's that not husband generational. Is locked up in a prison for
yes.
lots of years for doing some very horrible, terrible things.
Yes. I don't know what it says, but it says a lot for us as a society that we feel the need in reference to men to give them, but at least mm-hmm. excuses. You don't do that with women.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think it's generational, but it's also, we are living in a patriarchal society.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just what we live in, the culture mm-hmm. that we live in. Yeah.
All right, moving on to episode 4. Unless there's anything else with episode 3. Okay, I'm going to tell you guys, I'm still processing episode 3, to be honest.
Episode 3 was a lot. It was my favorite episode.
I have a friend who is a school psychologist, and I actually was asking her thoughts on this show because I was really interested to get her take, and she felt a lot of pressure when I told her we were going to be talking about it on the podcast because at first we were just chatting about it. And then when I said, well, we're going to be talking about this on the podcast, she was like, oh, I feel the pressure now because I was asking for her professional opinion, not just her personal right. opinion. So she says that some of the things that she had thought about, and she knows that some of these are possibly specific to the UK, but she thinks that here in the US, one of the primary issues that we have, besides that there is an increase in this toxic masculinity, is that we aren't doing a very good job of teaching social emotional regulation. And I think that you see that really well in this episode 3.
Mm-hmm.
She says, I think that we've pushed social emotional learning, or what you'll see in schools called SEL. But as far as regulating emotions, we don't often do a lot of that. She doesn't feel like we teach that. We don't teach coping skills for students.
Yeah.
And that can be part of the problem. We don't really teach a lot of interpersonal relationship skills, especially at the age that we're talking about here, which is 13. Don't talk about how do you deal with rejection. There's a lot of opportunities where we could do better and we aren't addressing topics. And so what's happening is they're getting this information, but they're getting this information from social media and from their fellow middle school friends or teenage or high school friends or whatever. But we're not teaching this to our students, which is a really good point. And on episode 3, you see that he does not know how to regulate his emotions.
No, he's trying.
Mm-hmm.
He catches himself when he has an outburst, but it's a manipulative way. Even with his outburst, he is manipulating her perception trying to manipulate her perception of the outburst because, oh, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. Or I'm sorry, I did a bad thing. Or I'm sorry, I did this, instead of like, why did that happen in the first place? Mm-hmm. You know, why were your emotions so all over the place that you did lash out like this at mm-hmm. me? He literally went straight, like she was sitting down, he stood up and he was standing over her and like yelling at her.
Uh-huh.
This was very strong verbal aggression. He threw his chair across the room, not at her, but right. he threw it across the room. And at the end, the guard had to like pull him out.
Yes.
He had to wrap his arms around Jamie and pull him kicking and screaming out of the room because mm-hmm. he could not get a handle on his emotions.
Yes. And it seems to me whenever he didn't get what he wanted, whether it was she didn't answer a question he wanted her to answer, or when she was not backing down from a question she was asking him. It just seemed like when he didn't get what he wanted, or when she was in control and exerting that control, which she should be the one in control. One, she's the adult, right?
Right.
And two, she's the professional. She's the psychiatrist. She should be the one in control of this situation. But when he's reminded of that, he does not react well to that, mm-hmm. which again speaks.
Because in his mind, she is beneath him.
Mm-hmm, because
she's a
woman.
Doesn't matter the age. Does not matter the age. Mm-hmm. She's a woman. He should be in control.
Yes.
Or the guard should be in control, because when she, like we've already talked about this, but when she waved him off and said, no, that's okay, I've got this, the guard asked if she needed help. Jamie said, who are you to tell him that?
Yeah. Who do you think you are?
You're a woman. He didn't say that, but he also made a point. The other psychiatrist, because she kept asking him these questions and he was mocking her. And he said the other one was much easier to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
I could figure him out more, or mm-hmm. something like that. And yeah, I just thought that was really interesting because he didn't trust her judgment at all.
Mm-hmm.
And he was afraid of what she would conclude.
Yeah. I think that we could talk for an hour just on this one episode, because there was a lot of layers. And I'm sure that if you guys are listening to this and you have watched this, you probably have a lot more thoughts mm-hmm. about it that we haven't even touched.
Well, I mean, this could be a depth conversation. Mm-hmm. Like,
well, and just the show in general, I've read a lot of different takes mm-hmm. from people, and it's so interesting how the next episode we're going to talk about, you and I have completely different takes on mm-hmm. that. And I think it's so interesting how so many people can be watching the same thing, mm-hmm. which we've talked about a lot on this podcast, based on your experiences and your history, and that creates the lens that you see the world. And we are watching the same thing here, but we are making yeah. different conclusions, having different takeaways.
We all have our own biases.
Have different perceptions of how we're viewing this and hearing this and receiving this. So I just think it's super interesting. Okay, so let's move on. Last episode, episode 4. So this is 13 months after the murder. We're following the family here.
Yeah.
And
this
so
is the
we're,
mom and the dad and the sister.
And the sister.
Older sister.
So we are back at the Miller house. It appears that they have tried to return to kind of like a new normal for them as Jamie awaits trial. Jamie is still in the detention center. Jamie's not a part of this episode. So it is the dad. His name is Eddie. The character's name is Eddie. It's his 50th birthday, and his van gets tagged by a group of teen boys that go to Jamie's school. And I didn't realize this the first time I watched it, but it's the same group of boys who are bullying Adam, mm-hmm. which is the detective's son. And so the family planned to go to the movies later to kind of lighten the mood. The day starts off okay. It's his birthday. I'm sure there's a lot of emotions there because it's his birthday and his son is in detention center. Yeah. They're celebrating it without him. I'm sure that feels sad, like something is missing. And then the daughter goes outside and realizes that the van has been spray painted, and it's spray painted with a word that means pedophile
mm-hmm.
In British slang, I guess. Mm-hmm. So they decide that this is not going to ruin their day. They're going to go to the hardware store and get some stuff to wash it off or cover it up or whatever. And they're going to go watch a movie, and they're going to get the day back. I think
yep.
that's what the dad
yep.
kept saying.
Yep.
We're going to get the day back. They are in the hardware store, and Eddie, the father, asks an employee for help. Wants to know what he can get to clean the van off. The employee is like, you're probably going to have to paint it. It's probably not going to come off. And then while he's having this conversation with the employee recognizes him mm-hmm. and kind of awkwardly expresses support for Jamie,
mm-hmm.
which is, again, just kind of leans into this whole culture of yep. this misogynistic incel culture, right? So the guy at the hardware store who looks like he's a teenager,
mm-hmm. he's very young,
maybe a young adult, but he looks to be probably a teenager, and he's like, hey, by the way, like, I'm on Team Jamie kind of thing. And the dad is like, kind of
very uncomfortable,
very uncomfortable, and kind of caught off guard by this. I can imagine that yeah. he would be. You're saying you're on my son's side, but my like
when he has seen the tape.
Yes. So they go out to the parking lot and they're getting ready to leave, and the same group of teens that tagged the car that rode their bikes by earlier yelling things at them, they had followed them. Yeah, they're in the parking lot. The dad kind of loses it. Mm-hmm. He goes over and starts yelling at them and grabs one by the collar and
throws his bike out at him.
Yes, and is basically saying, don't mess with me. You don't know what I've been through. Like, don't do that to people. And then he throws the paint on the car.
He does.
On the van to cover it up.
Yeah. And then the security guard comes out and says, you're on camera. Aren't you going to clean that up? And he says, no, I'm not.
Right.
And then he drives away.
So in the car on the way home, Jamie calls from the detention center and everyone is in the car. Mm-hmm. They hear this conversation. Jamie calls to speak to his dad. He doesn't know that everyone's in the car listening. And he tells his dad that he's decided to plead guilty. It's pretty emotional when he says that, but they're all trying not to show emotion. The dad basically checks out of the conversation yeah. at that point.
He has to stop talking. Uh-huh. It's very sad.
Then mom starts talking to Jamie, and that's when Jamie's like, oh, I didn't know you all were there. So mom, being mom, tries to check in on him mm-hmm. and ask how he's doing. And
she said she's written to, I don't know if he has some food allergies or something they're talking about. And she's like, I've written and told them how you need your stuff or mm-hmm. whatever, you know, just caring about him.
Taking care of her yeah. son. Yeah. And so when they get to the house, the dad goes in the house first. Mom and sister kind of stay in the van. It's really emotional. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of quiet time in yeah. this scene. And
a lot of processing.
It's heavy. And again, that's part of the great storytelling of this, because you are in it with them.
Yeah.
And there's no fast forwarding through that uncomfortable emotion. Like, you're sitting in there with them. Everybody goes in the house and mom has a moment. She mm-hmm. gets pretty emotional, which I think it also shows to just the family dynamics, right? Everyone is trying to hold it together. Mm-hmm. Everyone is trying not to show emotion.
Yeah.
And then when they are alone, that's when they mm-hmm. feel comfortable to be emotional.
Right.
So the mom goes upstairs and she and dad have a long conversation about everything. I think the reality and the weight of all of this is really setting in. I'm assuming that Jamie originally was going to plead not guilty. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if they were hopeful that despite the evidence right. that he would get off. I don't know, because we're not told that. And right. I think that's because that doesn't matter. When he makes that call and says, I'm going to plead guilty, that's when they realize that this is their life and this is yeah. their son's life and the weight of the situation. They talk in the bedroom for a long time. And one of the things that really struck me about this conversation, I think as most parents would in this situation, they're wondering, what did we do wrong? We thought we were keeping him safe. Mm-hmm. He was here. He was home. He was in his bedroom. We thought we were keeping him safe. And I think that points to the dangers of when we don't know what our kids are seeing online yeah. as a parent. You think that they're safe because they're in this house. And we talked about this when we talked about the anxious generation. We think that by not being out there in the world, we're protecting them. But what's happening is they're here behind closed doors and the world is coming into their mm-hmm. computer screen. And they're exposed to so much more dangerous information
than any other generation has ever experienced.
Yes. Yes. And so that really hits hard for the parents, because they're like, we thought we were keeping him safe. Mm-hmm. We thought we were doing the right thing.
Dad says he's talking to his wife and he says, my dad would beat me silly. He would lay into me. And I swore I would not do that with my kids. And I didn't do it. So how did I become a product of my dad? And I created this.
Mm.
And I was like, Wow. That's, yeah. I don't know. What a thought-provoking thing. Mm-hmm. Because how does violence beget nonviolence and nonviolence can beget violence? I don't know. I mean, there's more to it than just that, obviously. Right. But just him processing that, and I was trying to do better and not give my child the trauma that mm-hmm. I experienced. Mm-hmm. That was cruelty. And then this happens, and it was out of his control. I mean, well, and that's what they asked too. They were like, could we have prevented this?
Yeah. And their question, how did this happen? You and I had two completely different takes on this, but one of the things before we talk about that, one of the things I wanted to say about this episode towards the end of that episode of that conversation with the mom and dad, and I'm going to paraphrase here, but the daughter comes in and they're talking about like, let's just stay in and rent a movie, watch a movie or whatever, and order Chinese food, take out. And she, the daughter's like trying to be supportive and just be a good daughter, yeah. right? And she goes downstairs and there's a comment that the dad makes something to the effect of, how did we raise her that she turned out so well?
Mm-hmm.
And the mother responds with the same way we raised him.
Yeah.
And that was such a moment, because I think that parents carry, because this whole time we're seeing them process mm-hmm. and ask, what could we have done differently? What mm-hmm. could we have done better? Where did we go wrong? Where did we mess up? And the reality is they did this, they raised both their kids the same way.
Yeah.
And they didn't do anything.
Yeah.
But they just have this, like, I should have done better. And at the very last scene, I'm not even going to try to explain it because it is so heavy. I just encourage you to watch it if yeah. you haven't. If you have watched it, you know what we're talking about.
It's made me cry both times.
It is Ooh. So heavy that I'm words would not do it justice. You no. just need to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
But that last scene, and he's says, I should have done better. Mm-hmm. My husband and I, we watched it together. And when that was over, we just sat in silence for I don't even know how long. We were both crying and we had no words. So the different takes, it really displays for me how this looked like a normal family. Like a hardworking dad, a mom tried to do the best she could of loving her kids, was worried about the fact that they were going to draw blood and he's afraid of needles, making sure he's eating yeah. right, even in the detention center, you know, and a sister who she's in college. She's seems like a pretty good kid from what we can tell, you know, supportive of the family. They're all heartbroken and distraught and shocked by what has happened in their family. My take was that this was like a dad who was processing, who tried to do the best that he could, who couldn't, who was not used to showing emotion mm-hmm. as a lot of men typically are not. So he had a really hard time showing emotion. Even in the first episode, when he's sitting next to his son, who's crying, who's distraught, there's no comforting. There's no like physical affection yeah. of comforting there.
Yeah.
And when I watched that,
sitting right beside each other.
Yeah. Just going back to episode one, I was like, hug him. Uh-huh. Like, give your son a hug.
Yeah.
And then I was like, is he not allowed to do that? So that's what I took from that mm-hmm. when I'm watching that episode, was that it looked like a normal, good, hardworking family. And yet this still happened.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't your take.
No, I had a different perspective from this episode. So I think the one take, we've talked about this so many times, but it really shows the just rawness of the experience that they're having. At the beginning, the mom is making the dad breakfast for his birthday. And then the daughter realizes there's something written on the van, and the dad goes out to investigate it. And that changed his vibe.
Disposition.
His disposition for the day. He has come back in to get a bucket full of soap and water, and his wife kind of get into a little tiff because she's trying to like tell him it's going to be okay. He kind of gets in her face a little bit mm-hmm. and says, no, it's okay. I've got control of this. She wanted to stay home and continue to make him breakfast while he went to the store to get paint. I thought that there were several moments of the dad having those mini outbursts or microaggressions towards mom. And the moment at the store where he throws the paint onto the van, I was scared And whenever the security guard came out of the store asking him, aren't you going to clean that up? You've just like vandalized this property because there's paint on the ground too. I mean, it didn't all just go on the van. And he says no. And he drives away. And I was like, like, it made me so scared. I was like, oh my gosh, he just drove away. I don't know. It was not complete aggression. What made me wonder, because we just got off of episode 3, right? Mm-hmm. We just left Jamie berating the psychiatrist. And then I see the dad do the same thing to the mom in a micro way. Or do the same thing to the van or the teenage boys in the same way. And then we get home and the mom just starts to cry. I realized I had not seen the dad cry. In this whole season, the dad did not cry at the beginning of the first episode.
I think he did, but he was choking on his tears.
Yeah.
And in the exam room.
That's right. That's
and then
right.
Whenever okay. they watched the video.
Okay. So he did cry. Mm-hmm. But like you said, he's choking on his tears, mm-hmm. right? So the mom, like you could tell she was just having her moment. Like it's what she does often, like in the mudroom or whatever. And then I remembered there was a point, I think in episode 2, where the dad at the murder scene, mm-hmm. where there's flowers and signs and all that kind of stuff in honor of Katie. And he is standing there just sniffling, very stoic faced. Mm-hmm. And also, when the mom and the dad are up there talking, he is having a really hard time processing his emotions. And the mom is referring back to their therapist. Uh-huh. Remember what she says. Remember what Jenny said. Trying to help him process through his emotions and cope with what he's feeling. Because mm-hmm. they did just find out that Jamie's decided to change his plea.
When she says, remember what Jenny said, she said, don't shut me out.
Yes. Feel your emotions. Mm-hmm. Don't shut them out. Yeah, that's really good. And then the daughter comes in. You had talked about this a little bit. Mm-hmm. And she gets vulnerable with them. And she talks about how she is having a little bit of a hard time at school. And I think she sheds a few tears. And I just found it really interesting because the difference between the men in this miniseries coping and processing their emotions versus females. Even at the end of episode 3, the psychiatrist starts to cry. And she's processing all of this heavy stuff that she's gone through. And it just made me think, like, in this episode, I really was afraid of the dad. And I saw, or at least for me, I really noticed the difference between how they portrayed, at least what I thought their intention was, of how differently the women and the men process their emotions by crying, mm-hmm. specifically how much more difficult it was for the dad to cry versus how easy and normal it was for the women to do that.
Well, that's an interesting take because it's so different than my take. I mean, listen, there are probably a lot of people that will agree with you. I didn't see that. And maybe this is more about me and my generation.
No, but I think that this is supposed to generate different yes. ideas and different takes.
Because I didn't see in that episode, I didn't see a portrayal of toxic masculinity. I saw stereotypical masculinity. Mm-hmm. So I didn't see anything for me anyway that was toxic. I saw my dad, my grandparent, my brother in that. They don't show, not in the aggression, but in the I'm not crying. I'm not going to cry. I'm going to do whatever I can to not cry. And I even have felt that way before. Now it's a whole different story because of what I've been through. And I've been in spaces where I freely talk about my grief and things like that. So I have been in lots of places and stages where I openly cry. I don't even try to hold it anymore. But prior to that, I was a person who was like, I'm not going to cry in front of people. I hate crying in front of people. Mm-hmm. And also part of that is because once it starts for me, it's hard for me to stop. So it's like I did everything I could to like not cry. Mm-hmm. Another part, and this is a lot of gender roles too, like in the corporate world that I worked in, I couldn't show that I was a weak or emotional woman.
Yeah.
And so it was like, I am not going to cry because that's the last thing I want is to be like, oh, she's a woman. She's being emotional. Mm-hmm. But for me, I saw a portrayal of stereotypical masculinity where it is harder for the men to show emotion. It is harder for men to cry. And on the topic of the teens that tagged his car, you said you had no empathy for the dad in this situation. I had so much empathy for the dad. And I actually, again, this might say more about me, but I actually felt that he was justified because they had vandalized his van. He had gone through a whole lot of, and that's what he said to them. It's like, you don't know what I've been through. And I've seen a lot of takes on that where people have said, this is a very good example, a very good conversation to have with your sons, especially about like how to regulate your emotions, how to control your emotions. And maybe I'm old school in that, but I had empathy because the message I got is that you don't know what he's been through.
Right.
Like, you don't know the trauma he's experienced. And so you should not be mean. You should not be bullying. You should not be vandalizing. Not only should you not be doing those things, but you don't know what people have been through. Mm-hmm. So I had a lot of empathy for him in that situation. Especially, like I said, because he was saying, you don't know what I've been through.
Yeah.
And so I felt for him in that situation. But that's, I've read and I've seen a lot of people, that was not their take on that. And that's okay.
Well, back to what you were saying, like your dad and like, he didn't really show emotion. Did you say something like that?
Yeah. Like my dad was super affectionate.
Yeah.
But like he would not... Like, I've seen my dad cry, but he would try really hard not to.
Yeah.
Especially in front of people.
I had the opposite experience growing up. My dad, he cried a lot. Like, and not in a bad way. He was not, like, sad. But he will always say, I wear my heart on my sleeve.
Mm-hmm. And he's not afraid of that.
And yeah, he's not afraid of that. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that is... that's one of my biases or that's influencing my perception on this at all. Yeah. So I'm wondering if that's like a part of how I perceived this, because growing up, that was normal for me to see my dad express emotion and process emotion through tears. Mm-hmm. And so, interesting.
Yeah. Very
interesting. So funny how we all have like different experiences that shape our perceptions of things.
Yeah, we have so much more to talk about. That is the show.
Yeah.
Episodes 1-4 of Adolescence. Those are our takes on each of those episodes. But we have so much more to talk about.
Be back.
Does this matter?
Yes.
1,000%.
Yeah, whenever I watched this, I texted you and I was like, you have to watch this because I knew you have a 13-year-old son and it impacted me and I don't even have kids like this. So I was like, you have to watch this. I want to hear your thoughts too, because I knew this would be like so much more of like real time for you.
This hit home for me. Like I said, I have a 13-year-old son. So, and this is a 13-year-old boy that we're talking about, and a 13-year-old girl. So this hit, like it hit. Because you can't help as a parent to put yourself in the parent's shoes. What would you do?
Yeah.
And how would you as a parent try to keep this from happening in your home, with your household? But this is what I've told people since I've watched it. It's so important because not only if you have someone in your life that is this age, this is the world that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the next generation of men that are being raised.
Yeah.
And we think it's a small subculture on the internet that doesn't affect us. But let me tell you, this is not a small subculture on the internet that does not affect us. We will go into much more depth and detail about that next time. But this type of toxic masculinity, misogynistic, patriarchal, violence against women, oppressing women, man rights type of thinking is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It is in our schools. It is in our churches. It is in,
it's in our government.
Our government. It is not just on TikTok.
Mm-hmm.
And Instagram
and Facebook.
It is infiltrating our lives and our society as we know it. And that's why this is so important. It is not just if you have a 13-year-old in your house.
Exactly.
This is so important to understand. Also, to do better, to yeah. teach better, to show better. So yes, I think this is very important. And I think we're going to talk even more about why this is important next time.
Yes.
So final thoughts outside of that is watch the show. If you haven't watched the show, if you have watched the show, please let us know what you think about it. Would love to hear your thoughts and why you think this matters or doesn't matter.
I really enjoyed this conversation.
Yes.
And I really have enjoyed talking about this too, like with a few different friends that have watched this, because even back to the billboard that yeah, you
we're
saw,
still processing.
We're still processing. Mm-hmm. And I've heard like one of the writers or one of the producers say that was the whole intention of this. Like they said, this was not a whodunit. This is a why.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Not even why did this scenario happen? Why is this happening?
Mm-hmm.
Why is this culture being created and why is it growing?
Mm-hmm.
So yes. Let's explore the idea behind it and the intent behind it and the fuel that's adding to the fire, because this is continuing. This is growing. This is not getting smaller. Mm-hmm. This is not in the past. Like, we're going into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I think it deeply matters.
I think it's deeply relevant for the status of the world and the future. I know that some people are going to be like, oh, you guys are being so dramatic. And that's fine if you believe that. But I really think this is such an important conversation to have. I think that everyone should watch this and have conversations about it and yeah. open your eyes. Like, you cannot claim ignorance. You cannot say, I did not know. You cannot ignore it. Mm-hmm. When it comes to your attention,
right.
I think you have to pay attention.
Yeah.
Amen. So, okay. We're going to dive more into some of the topics we've discussed next time.
Yes.
So stay tuned for that.
Please join the conversation. We
yes.
have an email from x2zpod@gmail.com. So mm-hmm. if you don't want to have your thoughts out on social media, send mm-hmm. us an email. We can keep it anonymous. If you just want us to know, we would
yep.
love to read it either way.
Mm-hmm. Or if you want to DM us on Instagram, mm-hmm. You can do that too. As much as I love talking to Laura, it's a lot more fun when you all join in too. I think it's a deeply, deeply, deeply meaningful conversation to be continued. You've been listening to From X to Z podcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Joining us. And we will talk to you next time.
Bye.
Bye.